Hello, and welcome to Conversations for Thoughtful Judaism. My name is Sarah Labaton, and I'm Director of Teaching and Learning at the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America. One of the distinctive features of Judaism is the centrality of practice, behavior, and ritual. While there are many varieties of Jewish practice, modern Jews often bump up against the notion of obligation as expressed by the term mitzvah, translated literally as commandment. The conversation you're about to hear in this episode is an exploration of mitzvah and whether or how this core traditional concept is relevant for 21st century Jews and Judaism. This conversation is part of a set of three conversations about practice that you'll see in this podcast feed, which deal with topics such as the distinction between law and culture when it comes to Jewish practice, the role of personal narrative and relationship in Jewish practice, and ways in which Jewish practice is tied to holiness. All of these conversations are closely tied to Foundations for a Thoughtful Judaism, which is an introduction to Jewish thought meant for teachers and students of every background. You don't need to know anything about foundations in order to appreciate this podcast, but if you're interested in learning more once the episode is over, everything about it is on our website at shalomhartman.org/foundations. For this conversation about mitzvah, I spoke with Will Friedman and Shira Koch Epstein. Will is a doctoral candidate in ancient Judaism from Harvard University and a fellow and faculty member at the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America. Shira is the executive director of the Center for Rabbinic Innovation at Hillel International and a faculty member at the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America. Take a listen. Welcome, Will and Shira. It's great to have you here today. I would love to start our conversation by asking you to reflect a little bit about where you see the category of mitzvah playing out in your own lives. Will, how about if we start with you?
Sure. I'll start just by unpacking the term mitzvah a little bit, because I think there's a couple of different pieces to it. So one thing that I think mitzvah can refer to are actual practices, right? Actual mitzvot, the things that we do, like tefillin or honoring parents, right? Doing a mitzvah. But the other thing I think is mitzvah means command. And so I think sort of like underlying that term and the use of that term is this idea of obligation. The rabbis kind of talk about mitzvot as obligations and being obligated or not being obligated to do things. So I think there's these two different senses. One is specific practices, and one is the idea of obligation. And so I'll say that both are very meaningful for me. And if I start by talking about obligation for a second, it's really powerful for me to feel myself required to do something and to feel like there's an obligation holding itself over my head, in a sense. One of the ways I think that that's helpful is just when I'm feeling like in the doldrums about a particular practice and would just opt not to do it if it were just up to me. The feeling of obligation means that I keep persevering and I keep doing it. And I think that that gives those mitzvot a chance to reassert themselves and reinsert their importance once I get through whatever the challenging piece is that's making me feel disconnected from it. But obviously that wouldn't work if the mitzvot themselves were not meaningful, and I think they really are for me. Just very broadly, mitzvot are a way of having a structure and a framework. It's a daily structure, davening three times, praying three times a day. It's a weekly structure, having Shabbat. It's a yearly structure, having holidays at various punctuated points during the year. And so just the doing of mitzvot gives that framing to things. Saying blessings is a chance to frame even the most mundane things like going to the bathroom and eating food. And I'm not going to pretend that I don't mumble through those most of the time, but the opportunity is there. And if I force to stop myself and think about what I'm saying, it can actually be helpful to like see some of those individual daily moments as part of a broader part of the universe. And if I didn't have the ongoing framework of mitzvot, I'd think I would never do that. I'm not a meditator. I'm not a mindful person naturally. So mitzvot are a helpful framework for me for like connecting when I choose to and when I can force myself to being more mindful about those things.
Great. We'll pick up on some of the threads that you raised a little bit later on, but Shira, I'd love to hear from you.
Sure. I feel like I need to explain this by way of a story from my childhood. I am a sort of strange breed of Jewish person in the world because I was raised by a fairly halachically observant Reform rabbi father and a mother who had become Orthodox and then went to the Jewish Theological Seminary as a conservative Jew. And we lived among no Jews. We were the only observant Jews where I grew up. And I'm a person who has sort of struggled and then intellectually come around to really study the balance and the question of the autonomy of the individual and divine authority. And when I was 3 years old, maybe 3 and a half, because I remember it, we lived next to a family named the Vigianos. They're still around. We're Facebook friends. But Laura was my very best friend. They were not Jewish. They were Catholics. Mrs. Vigiano, as far as I remember it, I don't know this for sure. I remember her being a religious Catholic. She had made two sandwiches for us. Laura had a ham and cheese, and I had a peanut butter and jelly. And being 3 and a half or 4 years old, we swapped halves of our sandwiches. And Mrs. Vigiano, she came out and she found me eating the ham sandwich. And you can imagine a devout Catholic finding that she had fed the rabbi's daughter a ham sandwich. And we ran me to my father to say, oh my goodness, I fed her a ham sandwich, with like probably visions of burning and hell. So she was so apologetic for what she must have done to my soul. And my father, at least the way I remember the story, explained to Mrs. Vigiano that it wasn't that we kept kosher because God needed us to do so. We kept kosher because it was something that we needed to do in order to connect and to feel responsible. And he always used the example, I mean, we did keep kosher in a place where we were the only ones. And he would say, and he probably got it from some of the intellectuals I've later learned had things to say about this, but he basically was of the mind that mitzvah is not only the good deeds we do, but often the negative mitzvot are about regulating our animal behaviors. So eating, sex, going to the bathroom, right? Those are animal behaviors that we must do like the rest of the animal kingdom. But because we have the ability to make decisions about how we behave, the mitzvot are there to help us remember to connect to the divine in the decisions we make. And so it's not that I couldn't eat ham because somehow I would be destroying my soul or irreparably doing something against God, but rather I was protecting the divinity that I was being called to respond to by choosing to make those choices every day. And if I could make those choices every time I put food in my mouth, how much more so could I make those choices when they really impacted ethics? And I'll just say that the notion of mitzvah for me as a Jew who feels myself called as an autonomous individual to connect to the imperative of the divine is very much influenced not only by my dad, but I realize, first of all, the sovereign power of the ethical claim. So it's like the ethics behind why we do the things we do are what obligate me to do them. And so there are mitzvot where the ethics are questionable, and therefore, while I struggle with them, I might choose not to do them, because I feel that the ethical call and also the relational call of how I interact with another human being might call me to, and some would find this heretical, but to choose that it's not a mitzvah that I feel may be coming from a divine imperative of the ethical.
Yeah, you referenced an amazing story from your childhood, and I would love to hear a little bit about whether or not your relationship to mitzvah has changed or evolved over time, and what have been some of the inflection points in your relationship to this category?
Absolutely. So I have so many stories, right? That's how it goes. But for sure, I was raised with the narrative of my father that the reason he followed halakha is he understood the reform idea that you do the mitzvot that call you to your highest self and to relationship with God. And if they don't do that, then you might choose not to do them. It's not how most reformed Jews in practice go about making their choices about mitzvah, but he did, and he tried them all on. He took on a halachic lifestyle, and then he kept the things that he felt did that. I didn't make that choice, but also that's not my relationship. I said that my relationship is about being ethical, but it's also very much about the relational. There's another piece, and if there's a theologian who said this, I will love to know who. As a person of stories, I actually believe that we are narrative creatures, and that the only way we understand anything is by the stories that we tell. And they influence our behavior, they influence how we relate to others, and they influence how we understand what happens. And as a Jew, my narrative is the Jewish narrative, and mitzvot are the way that I enact that Jewish narrative. And so I feel a connection to do mitzvot that also don't call me to an ethical imperative, because they connect me to the Jewish people. And so I, for example, might keep a higher level of kashrut in my home than I feel I'm ethically called to do to have that relationship with God, because number one, that's how our people eat. And number two, it allows me to connect to the Jewish people, to have other people in my home. And a story, it's a weird story. So I went to Israel for a semester when I was 15, and I was so happy. Finally, I could eat out. I could go and feel like I was part of something. But I lived with a secular Russian family as my host family who, other than Friday night kiddush, they didn't observe any Jewish rituals or anything that they considered mitzvot. It just wasn't their way of framing things. And I would go out to nightclubs with their daughter. And I remember it was Shavuot, we had no school, and I went to a nightclub in downtown Jerusalem, and we were partying all night long. And it was like 5 a.m. or 6 a.m., I don't know, really early in the morning, and we were coming out of the nightclub, and I suddenly saw throngs of clearly identifiably observant Jews heading down to the Kotel, to the Western Wall. And I had this incredible feeling that I was meant to be with them, not at the nightclub. And that while I had thought I was so excited to go to a place where being Jewish and my Jewish identity did not have to be tied up in ritual observance or in categories of mitzvot, that was the kind of Jew that I was. And so I didn't feel that there was a natural place for me among those Jews walking to the Kotel as a liberal woman, but I did know that the categories that they understood their Jewishness to fall in, which are mitzvot, rituals, obligations, were at least the body of people that I felt more connected to be a part of. And that was a turning point for me in making my own choices to be more observant.
Those are really interesting and inspiring stories, Shira. In some ways, I didn't have the privilege of your upbringing. I grew up in a nominally observant family and who was part of a conservative synagogue. And we actually kept Shabbat and Kashrut certainly more strictly than anybody else in our community, but not in accordance with what I would later discover were the terms of the normative texts. So I had some of that, and I went to public school. I grew up in New York, so plenty of Jews around, but I never really felt the kind of a tension between those practices that we did in my family and the secular world that I was basically a part of until I went to college and kind of had to make some decisions about, now that I had autonomy for my family, at least, I had to sort of make some decisions about what kind of Jewish life I was going to lead. And I was fortunate in a somewhat similar, although less dramatic way than your story about the Jews on Shavuot, where I went to college, there was a small but very robust Orthodox presence and not very much else. And being in that environment of people who were like very learned, very committed, made me jealous a little bit to figure out like, what do they see in all of this? And can I access it? Can I be a part of it? And so over time, I threw myself more and more into Jewish learning. I could read Hebrew characters, but didn't know Hebrew as a language. Thanks, Hebrew school growing up. So I started to learn Hebrew, and I started to read some of the canonical texts of the tradition. And I found myself really falling in love with what seemed to be a very rich, deep conversation about how to live a good life. You know, sometimes I tell people that my way into the humanities, poetry, literature, philosophy, political theory, legal theory, was through the Talmud, and they look at me like I'm nuts. But actually, I found in learning Talmud and its multifarious commentaries and just the rich body of Jewish traditional wisdom that I felt like, oh, this is a way to be powerfully Jewish and authentically engaged with like important issues in the world. And that's a mitzvah, right? Learning Torah is a mitzvah. But that also helped me as I threw myself more and more into learning and spent many years in yeshiva and found very important teachers who helped shape my thinking around this to see mitzvot as a component of living out those values, and that mitzvot themselves are a way of being in the world. I actually am less inclined to use the word mitzvah and more inclined to use the word halakha, because for me, halakha is the dynamic process of applying the wisdom of the past to the circumstances of the present. And so I found myself not needing that sense of like a theology of autonomy that Shira talked about, because once I was deep enough in the multivocal texts of the Jewish tradition, I realized that all of the options are available, and what you actually needed to do was, instead of making choices to accept or reject, to figure out what are these mitzvot about, what are they trying to accomplish, and then what's the way to accomplish those goals given the shifts that have happened around gender, around sexuality, around sort of material possibility, economics, things like that. And it's that process of halakha, that process of figuring out how to properly apply mitzvot to the world that we live in, where I find and derive a lot of that meaning. So I don't actually feel so much of that tension around acceptance and rejection, because eventually, after many, many years of learning, I've gotten to a place where I feel like I have sufficient understanding to be able to do that in an authentic way.
When you say that there's always a way, when you say that, are you saying where there's a will, there's a halachic way? Because you can reinterpret halacha to mean what you think it means, even if that's not the traditional rabbinic understanding? Or are you saying, I can always come up with an argument as to why this is ethical or why this is okay, even though many people may find it to feel unethical or to infringe upon their personhood in relationship to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really powerful question. So I think there's a little bit of both elements there. So one element for me is the principle of charitable reading, where I read a text, it seems crazy, terrible, awful on its face. First, I have to figure out, like, okay, wait a minute. So why do I find that to be awful? What are the value assumptions that I'm bringing from the context in which I live that make me react this negative way to this text? And then to the extent that I trust that the authors of the text that I was reading were ethical within their context, were trying to be ethical within their context, then it's upon me to figure out why would they make such a decision, right? Why would they make a decision that to me seems obviously terrible, but to them seemed obviously good? And I find that that process of engagement, of that charitable reading, of trying to figure out, like, what were the good things that they were trying to accomplish, then helps me feel like, okay, now I can actually own this terrible thing, because once I understand it, I don't need to follow it slavishly, but I can follow it wisely, to the extent that God has given me wisdom, to be able to say, like, okay, here are the things they were worried about, here are the things they were trying to accomplish, and how can that be translated into my context? So sometimes new ideas will come out and I'll realize that, oh, the way my context is thinking about this thing is actually bad or missed something, right? I get wisdom from the text. And at the same time, I don't feel beholden to an unethical demand, because if the demand is unethical, either I haven't understood it properly to understand this ethics, or I haven't applied it properly to make it ethical in my context. I guess what I'll say is mitzvah feels a little static to me as a category. It's like take it or leave it. Here's a mitzvah. Here's a list of the 613 mitzvot or whatever. They exist on paper, black and white, and there's very little room to maneuver in that kind of rhetorical framework. Whereas for me, the rhetorical framework of halakha, it just feels like constantly moving and shifting and like open to interpretation and flowing through different contexts. I mean, one of the reasons I love reading the responsa literature is that like you just get these crazy questions that you would think there's no way for halakha to respond. And then it does. And then the wise interpreter figures out how to respond in a way that is, at least in their eyes, ethical.
I appreciate that reading. I actually love studying halakha for the same reason, that it does change over time in terms of how it's interpreted. And I'm not a legal mind, but I appreciate that process. But also it's a path, and paths have boundaries that sometimes hem you in, right? And so one of the challenges that I have with halakha as a practice, not just the practice of parsing it, but the practice of living it, is that in that process, it is normative to say we do not reject what has come before. We find a way to make sense of it, as you were saying, but often I find that becomes apologetics that are very challenging. Not always, but often, especially on the things that have the most dubious ethical claims in the way we've come to understand ethics. And so I know Kaplan said the past has a vote, but not a veto. And I've heard that said as halacha has a vote, but not a veto. He said the past, not halacha. So I think there is something very relevant there. But for me, maybe it's also because I grew up in an American context where so many people believe a mitzvah is a good deed. I have a positive connotation with the word, even as I know that it also is a lot of things not to do, not just good things to do. And also many of the things it says to do, categorically, it's not clear why they're good. Always shotness, mixing wool and linen comes up. Like, how can we come up with a reason that that's a good thing to do other than God said to? Very challenging. And yet, to me, there's something very active about doing a mitzvah. Halakha is active in the aggregate, and mitzvah is active in the individual act. And I appreciate the aggregate, right? I'm the person who said we're reliving a narrative that has existed for long before us. And when we do a mitzvah, we're acting out that narrative in a way that makes us remember. Okay, so I'm not saying that we're not actively part of something historical and part of our memory when we do a mitzvah. But as someone who very much is about the autonomous self connected to a people, the idea of a mitzvah just feels easier to me than saying halakha, because each mitzvah is its own mitzvah as opposed to a body of things that become less valuable if you don't do all of them. So I think that's why mitzvah is a category that I just feel in my personal practice more connected to, even though halakha is what I study.
I want to pick up on that, Shira. So each of you spoke really poignantly and powerfully about some of your own personal journeys and narratives and your relationship to mitzvah and to halakha. And I would love to hear each of you reflect on the question of whether, and you can either take it in the vein of mitzvah or halakha, are these categories which are important or necessary for 21st century Jewish identity, for 21st century Judaism.
I actually think that's a great jump from what Shira was just saying. So I'll say that for me, I feel like a Judaism that's not constituted by a robust set of shared practices isn't particularly compelling. I feel that way for two reasons. One is, I think without any normative component, there's a real danger that Judaism just becomes another ethnic identity for its own sake. And that can lead to terrible things. The desire to have an ethnic identity absent any content seems to me to lead to really bad political outcomes. So that's the first thing. I think, like, there needs to be content to a culture in order for it to be valuable. And then I'll say the second thing, and this connects a little more directly to what Shira said, which is, for me, an assumption of a lot of the traditional wisdom around mitzvot is that mitzvot draw their power from being embedded in a community. There's a lot of contemporary anthropological literature about this idea of plausibility structures. It only makes sense to engage in certain ritual acts if the entirety of the community and the society is engaged in those acts. That it is the very fact of it existing that gives it its power and its meaning. And I think that that can shift over time. Like, tefillin probably made a lot more sense when everybody was wearing amulets and the Greeks were like, yeah, Zeus, and we were like, Hashem, right? So, like, in a culture in which everyone's wearing some kind of boxes strapped to their body, then, like, yeah, it makes sense for us to say, like, okay, we do that, but for our thing and not your thing. Now, in a post-Hellenistic world, tefillin had to take on a different set of meanings. And in fact, just as an example, tefillin were not practiced by most Jews most of the time. There's about 1,000 years of history from the Talmud until the early medieval period when everyone's complaining about how no one's wearing tefillin and only one person is. And there's an amazing question where it's like, if I put on tefillin, am I being arrogant because nobody else is? So, like, mitzvot go in and out, right? They go in and out of practice and they go in and out of consciousness. But I think that generally speaking, mitzvot often make the most sense and are the most powerful if they are embedded in a community of practice. And the very community of practice is what allows for it to have multiple meanings. I'll say sort of one more thing about the first thing that I said about the danger of an ethnic identity without a robust set of shared practices. So Rambam has, Maimonides has this like amazing line where he says, if you see somebody acting cruel, assume that they're not Jewish. And it's a hyperbolic statement derived from some hyperbolic statements in the Talmud. But I think what he's basically saying is unless our ethnic identity means something, unless there's something attached to it, then what even would be the point? Not being cruel is not like a specific mitzvah or a specific normative practice, but it is sort of an underlying theme of what many of the mitzvot are trying to accomplish. And I think that in a lot of ways, mitzvot work in tandem to create that kind of community and that kind of set of attributes that would characterize us as a people.
So Shira, as a rabbi, scholar, leader in the Jewish community, I would love to hear from you. If you think that mitzvah is an important or necessary category for 21st century Jewish identity and Judaism?
That's a great question. And I actually want to respond a little to what Will was saying. I appreciate his perspective. The idea that you need to live among a body with robust Jewish practices, that an ethnic identity absent of content is problematic. And I think with that, that when you're talking about practice, that you're talking about halacha or mitzvah in those categories. And I would argue that there is a way to be a thick, rich, connected Jew that is not only dependent on the categories of halacha and mitzvah. And this is why I talk about narrative, right? The idea that these practices are a way of engaging with and living out our narrative. But I think that when we say Torah, we're saying something more expansive than simply the practices of halacha and mitzvah. And I say that because I look at Jewish artists who express Jewish narrative in ways that are not categorically mitzvah and are not categorically halacha, but are expressions of Torah making manifest in the world when they're based on our narratives, which include halacha and mitzvah, right? But they aren't necessarily practicing those things. The same thing, I think that there can be an ethnic Zionism or an ethnic Judaism that is devoid of the narratives of our people that call us to something higher than just saying, my blood is Jewish, which I do not like blood and land concept of Judaism. It's problematic to me for any culture or ethnicity. And yet, I do believe that there can be a thick cultural Jewish expression that expresses and knows a connection to Jewish narrative. So let's just take, for example, the author Jonathan Safran Foer. I don't know him now, but I once knew him, and I know that he at that time was not a practicing halachic Jew. But when I read and Everything is Illuminated, the piece where he talks about the Jew feeling the pinprick that goes back to his grandfather, goes back to Abraham and the knife, right? That is a thick connection to narrative that is about memory, right? The Jewish person having this Jewish memory of the Akedah in their lived experience that is not necessarily borne out by living through halacha and mitzvah. And the last thing I'll say is I really strongly believe, more of a Hasidic idea, that the face of God is reflected in all of the different expressions of Jewishness, and that that mosaic would be incomplete if any Jewish person or person who identifies as a Jew was left out of the picture. And therefore, were there not a collective of people who carried out mitzvot and halacha, I think this would be also devoid of meaning. But if we left off the Jews who have cultural expressions of that narrative that are not lived out through halacha and mitzvah as categorical imperatives, I think we'd also be missing something tremendous of the Jewish people and of Torah being expressed and God's presence being expressed in the world.
I just want to say that I feel what you said very strongly, Sharon, and I actually agree with you. So maybe it'll help to just sort of latch onto the narrative piece, which is to say that I also think that narrative is crucial and central. There's a contemporary law narrative movement, which is to say that law tells a story within existing narratives. And so I think you're totally right. I mean, the Torah itself obviously is like that. Of course, you can have multiple wives, but it's going to work out very poorly for you, right? That's kind of one of the like funny messages if you read Breishit and then you read Devarim. So 100% narrative is right. I guess where I would sort of differ or maybe even push back is to say that I think it's important to distinguish between the individual experience, which is infinite, right? There are infinite individual experiences. You know, the rabbis already knew that when they said that God made every individual unique. At the same time, I think, at least when I think about mitzvah and halakha as normative frameworks, I think it's really important to kind of like come to terms with the fact that like any normative framework, any rule is going to sometimes be over-inclusive or under-inclusive, meaning that not everybody's going to fit. Maimonides says this explicitly in a section of The Guide to the Perplexed, where he's like, yeah, it's not going to work for everybody. Not every mitzvah is going to work for everybody, but we still maintain that normative framework because it works for most people most of the time. And then hopefully we can kind of like work out the exceptions in some way that doesn't really hurt people. So I think you're totally right that like everyone's narrative experience is deserving of being honored, and everyone's voice is a crucial contribution to the large tapestry of Judaism and Jewish practice. And at the same time, I think that we should, at least from my perspective, I think we also have to be okay with the fact that whatever community unifying practices we choose are going to exclude somebody some of the time, and that we should both work to minimize the harms caused by that, while at the same time recognizing that any choice is going to lead to some sense of exclusion and to kind of reconcile with that.
I agree with Will on the sense that there needs to be some collective venture together and maybe even ways of behaving or acting together that weave us together. But I'm not sure that I think that in the 21st century, when we look back on history and we look to the current situation, that halakha is actually the Jewish norm. I think that there is a rabbinic understanding or rabbinic vision that halakha is the Jewish norm. But I would argue that there are certain practices in a halachic way and in a non-halachic way that are Jewish norms, like making Shabbos on a Friday night and having Shabbat dinner may be much more of a Jewish norm than saying a bracha after you go to the bathroom. In terms of just the norms of the Jewish people, when you look at the totality of the Jewish people, I'm not suggesting that it's not a textual norm to assume that everybody does those things. But I don't think that practically it is a truth of the Jewish people that actually doing all of those mitzvot is what have held us together. I would argue, you know, more than the Jewish people have kept Shabbat, Shabbat has kept the Jewish people. I love that line. I think there's something very true to that. But as a person who considers myself Zocheret Shabbat, not Shomeret Shabbat, right? I'm someone who is cognizant of Shabbat. I do most of the do-dos. I prepare, but I don't necessarily not do what are considered malachot, the forbidden actions. But I do think that that connection to Shabbat as a concept is very important. And I'll also argue that when you look at what rabbis have to learn in the traditional seminaries to be rabbis, they don't actually have to know every single rule of halacha. They need to know the halachot that most people connect to on a certain level, right? What do we do in our homes? What do we eat? How do we practice our family relations and relationships? So I would just argue that there are norms that are among the Jewish people that we base our collective understanding upon that may not fit the category of doing mitzvot or walking the path of halacha. That's where I just want to push back about what's normative.
I entirely hear you and agree with you on a descriptive basis, Shira. I think that you're totally right. In contemporary terms, I think you're totally right historically. I mean, I brought up the example of the tefillin that didn't get worn for 1,000 years by most Jews, right? So I 100% agree that there is, have been, and always will continue to be gaps between textual normativity and communal practice. And I think the narrative pieces sometimes fill in within those gaps. From my perspective, I think that the failure of many Jews to connect with halakha and practice more generally, I think that applies, by the way, even in communities that are outwardly observant, that there's a failure to connect. I think that failure is entirely on Jewish leadership, and in particular on rabbis, and in particular on the masters of the textual tradition, to make it relevant, to understand what it is about, and to translate it into ways that are appropriate in our contemporary context. And I think that some of that comes from fear, some of that comes from the rapid pace of contemporary change. But when you read, when I read the reflections, especially from the founding of the State of Israel by leading rabbis on questions of government, on questions of being part of an international community, on democracy, trying to get those into Jewish sources that they didn't deal with democracy, right? They didn't deal with the UN. They didn't deal with any of that stuff. And seeing the radical and fascinating ways in which they drew on the resources in the tradition to translate it into a way that would allow for the establishment of a contemporary state that would look a certain way and would function in a certain way. And I think they wanted it to function in a good and ethical way on the national and international stage. I think that there's a lot more work to be done educationally to bring to bear the resources of the textual tradition in a way that could enhance contemporary Jewish life, and to move away from this idea of people are or are not going to observe a certain set of static norms, and to try to bring people more into a larger conversation about what it is that we're trying to accomplish through Jewish practice, and through that journey into learning that there might be a chance to bring it to greater relevance and ultimately observance in whatever form that will end up.
I actually think as an ending, we've come to a place where we are in agreement. Because while I think that our understandings might encourage different kinds of practice, I think that you're bringing up how halacha and Jewish narrative and Jewish law and mitzvah impacted the founding of the State of Israel and how the State of Israel operates. But halacha is not the law of the land. And talking about finding inspiration and actually learning more in order to be inspired to do more, I actually fully agree with you there. I would just talk about that in terms of personal autonomy and the sovereign power of the ethical claim, right? That God is somehow calling us to a higher ethics in relationship with each other, and that we need to unpack halacha to understand that. And I think we actually fully agree when we talk about that path of deciphering halacha, we might just come down in a different place about what the imperative is to follow the exact actions that are prescribed by that halacha.
Thanks so much, Will and Shira, for a rich conversation about mitzvah and the role that this concept plays in your lives and communities. We touched on the tension between personal autonomy and traditional notions of obligation, the meaning or meanings that underlie the concept of mitzvah, and whether other ideas such as narrative or halacha, Jewish law, might resonate more for Jews in today's day and age. Conversations for a Thoughtful Judaism is a product of the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America. This episode was produced by David Zvi Kalman and edited by Alex Dillon. Like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, these conversations also connect to an introduction to Jewish ideas that we've developed for both teachers and students called Foundations for a Thoughtful Judaism that is meant for learners of every background. So if you liked what you heard, you may want to take a look. To find out more, go to shalomhartman.org/foundations. There's also a link in the show notes. Thanks for listening.